Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Here is the sound of a place called Lincoln Meadow in the Sierra Nevada in June of 1989. That audio was collected after a campaign of what's called selective logging, to remove one or two species of trees from a forest while leaving the rest intact. It sounds like an eco-friendly alternative to clear-cutting, until you hear what Lincoln Meadows sounded like just a year earlier, before selective logging. The thing is, if you were to see photos of Lincoln Meadow before and after that logging, it wouldn't look much different. But listening tells a different and more complete story. And that is why my guest has dedicated his life to collecting and protecting the sounds of the natural world. Bernie Krause is a soundscape ecologist, musician, and author of the new book Voices of the Wild: Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can learn about his work at wildsanctuary.com. Bernie, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. Thank you.
You have three categories for sources of sound: biophony, geophony, and anthropophony. Can you explain the differences?
Well, the soundscape is all of the sound that we hear at any given moment, and really it's divided into three sources, the origins of sound. And these categories that I first identified are, one, the geophony. That's the non-biological sound that occurs in any given habitat. And it includes the effect of wind in the trees, grasses, water in a stream, waves at the ocean shore, or movement of the earth. And long before any living organisms appeared on the earth, these were the first sounds that were ever created. And the second of these is the biophony, and that's the collective sound that's made up of all vocal organisms in a given habitat, whether they live on land or in marine habitats. And the third is the anthropophony. And the anthropophony is all of the sound that we humans make. Some of them are controlled, like music or language or theater, while most are random and chaotic, and they're incoherent. And other than the fact of their presence, they contain no useful information. It's what I refer to as noise. And the reason that I've used these three terms, the anthropo means human. Once I made a mistake in my earlier book, and I called it anthropophony.
I think that's how I mispronounced it just now. So,
well, it's funny because I did too, and I called it, anthro means cave in Greek, and so I wasn't talking about the sounds of caves. I was talking about the sounds that humans make, and it's like anthropology.
Right.
You know, you hear that P-O. So it's anthropophony. Phone, of course, is the Greek word for sound. So biophony means the sounds of living organisms, and geophony means just the sounds of the earth, the natural sounds of the earth.
What's remarkable is that while geophony and biophony are very ancient, the dominance of anthropophony, the sounds that exist because humans make them, that's a relatively recent development in the history of the earth.
Well, recent, over the past 10,000 years, mm-hmm. I suppose. The idea of anthropophony, of course, affects all of the other natural soundscapes that are, prevalent in our world. And we're having a profound effect on that. The noise that's created, that we create, is phenomenal. And what it does is it masks the important communications of other living organisms that need to thrive as well.
How did animals in general evolve responsiveness to sound and ability to produce it and use it themselves?
That's a really good question. If you think about it, if an animal's survival depends on its voice, then it has to have a clear channel of communication to express itself. So as organisms developed with sound over time, from the time of the first rangiomorphs many millions of years ago, they evolved so that their voices kind of were partitioned into different channels, so that their sounds operated in a clear channel, a clear frequency channel, or a clear temporal channel, meaning that when one organism stops singing at one pitch, another critter would come in and fill in that niche so that its voice could be heard. So the animals have established these clear partitioned channels of vocalization. Insects have theirs, birds have theirs, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, each have their own channels of vocalization that are clear channels so that their voices can be both sent and received.
So they're listening to one another, even those of different species, so that they can make sure that whoever they want to talk to is paying attention.
Exactly right. And it gets even more complex when you get further and further away from from tropical zones, because in temperate zones that we live in North America, the birds actually are able to change internally in their brain. They're able to change frequency and shift frequency that they hear so that their voices fit within these what I call channels or niches, so that they can reconstruct their voices internally and be able to hear one another.
So, Bernie, what are the goals of soundscape ecology?
Well, soundscape ecology is a new definition, and what it really means is that it's important to it's a new field that sheds light on both science and culture. It's the study of how human animal sounds inform us about many fascinating subjects. Of course, I concentrate on natural sounds, or the sounds that come from the wild and remote places. And it's really exciting to be engaged with wild places and to learn about soundscapes. All we need to do first is really quiet down a bit and learn to listen. And again, it's just like our ancestors did. And when we do, I think we'll discover how we got our music, how we learned language, how we can know more about our human relationships to all things wild, and how we evolved culturally. And since wild soundscapes are the voice of the natural world, essentially, my new book, Voices of the Wild, is a guide to the future of many aspects of science and the ways those soundscape stories affect the way we choose to live. And by the way, soundscapes are a narrative of place. And if we want to understand the living value of a place, we need to understand what the soundscape is telling us.
And yet so many of us live our lives really isolated from sound, right? We put headphones in so we only hear the thing we want to listen to. We buy cars that are sealed up and we don't pick up a lot of road noise. We make sure that the windows in our house keep out the sounds of nature and traffic.
Sure, sure. And it's really important to pay some attention to that, because really the sounds of the wild are very healing. And it's important to be connected to that. There's a fellow by the name of Richard Louv who wrote a book, Last Child in the Woods. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, the premise of that book is how important it is to engage our children in the natural aspects of the natural world experience. Because the wild teaches us so many important things about our own lives and how we can best, in a healthy way, survive as a culture. And he and many others have suggested that the further we draw away from the natural world, the more pathological we become as a culture. And if you don't believe that, well, just take a listen to the evening news.
Have the goals of soundscape ecology broadened over time? Have they shifted since the time that you and some of your colleagues began to do this work in earnest?
Well, soundscape ecology, the term and the ways in which we've defined it, is a very new field. It's not 1,200 days old, if you want to count them in days. It's about 4 years. And so we haven't really had a chance to see what its evolution will be. However, the term soundscape was invented by a Canadian composer and naturalist by the name of R. Murray Schafer. And Schafer came up with the term soundscape in 1977. And when I got involved in natural sound and began to write about it, I found that there was a real lack of language and terms in English, certainly American English, to define what we were hearing, because we're mostly a visual culture. And so we don't have many terms to describe what we hear. So I began to think about ways in which we could give this idea a new language, hence the geophony, biophony, anthropophony idea. And for all the listeners out there, we're looking for more terms. So by all means, go out there and hear the world and tell us, describe to us what you're hearing in your own language.
For a long time, Bernie, I know that the emphasis in recording sounds of nature was on isolating certain noises, animal vocalizations. What do we miss when we don't capture these things in the context of the places where they naturally occur? If we, put a frog in a box and take audio.
Well, since the beginning of recording in the late 1890s, recording in the field, that is, the recordists have really concentrated on capturing individual creatures out of context of the whole biophony of the forest. And what they, once they established that model, they really kept going at it and recording life lists of different birds. There are approximately 10,000 species of birds, and then mammals, and then insects and frogs and so on. And so there are these huge collections of sound. But what people didn't realize what they were doing was they were reducing and abstracting, deconstructing the natural world and fragmenting it into incoherent parts. And when you decontextualize things that way, you achieve one goal at the expense of another. And the goal that you achieve is you get individual sounds, okay, and you get the numbers, okay, and you have these huge collections, but they don't really mean anything. Except that you can learn to identify the sounds of certain critters. Well, when I got involved in this work, I come from it from the perspective of a musician. I was a professional musician before I became a bioacoustician. And I learned that the context is much more important than the individual parts. It's kind of like trying to understand the magnificence of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony by abstracting the sound of a single violin player out of the context of the orchestra and hearing just that one part.
It's hard to do it. Impossible.
Very hard.
My guest is soundscape ecologist, musician, and writer Bernie Krause. His new book is called Voices of the Wild: Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with soundscape ecologist, musician, and writer Bernie Krause. We're talking about his new book, Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. So, Bernie, what we just heard there included some sound in interspersed with all the bird song of something, a creature called the Wyoming toad. And people listening might just think, well, that's very nice. There's a toad captured in this soundscape. But this was incredibly exciting information when it was captured.
Well, we're not sure it was the Wyoming toad.
That's right. Okay.
We only think it was. It was recorded in 2010, I think. I've been recording at this place just northeast of Jackson Hole. And one morning we were out there recording at dawn and heard the sound that sounded very much like the what was thought to be the extinct Wyoming toad. And we've sent it to a number of scientists who are very puzzled by that, the herpetologists. And they were very puzzled by the sound because a Wyoming toad hasn't been seen or heard in that area for a very long time. And they went back to try to also record where we recorded and haven't had much luck in the last couple of years, although the weather, of course, has been changing radically. So it may not be there any longer. But sure enough, we got that sound of that toad, and it is on record for having been at least thought of, rediscovered at that spot once again.
And describe the location. This would not be a place where it would be easy to just visually spot a Wyoming toad if one happened to be there.
Right. It's actually about 10 and a half miles northeast of Moose, Wyoming, which is in the Jackson Hole Basin near the entrance to the Grand Teton National Park, and it's a place called Spread Creek Pond, which is kind of a remote area. You have to drive a bit on some logging roads in order to get there, and it's a spot I've been recording since 1981, and it's of course, the habitat itself has gone through many changes since 1981 when I first recorded there and did the first digital recordings, by the way, and what happened was what has happened at that particular spot that we've noticed is since the spring, the season of spring, is occurring about 2 weeks earlier every season now than it did in the early 1980s, the whole spectrum of birds, the density and diversity of birds has completely changed. And the habitat has completely changed. Where it used to be filled with about 2 feet of water, that depression is now just a kind of muddy area. So it might have welcomed the toad back again just simply because of the changes that have taken place over time. And a lot of that is due to, of course, global warming.
Sound can sometimes tell a more complete story than other kinds of observation alone. We heard at the top of the show the Lincoln Meadow recordings. I want to listen now to some audio before and after the clear cutting in a place called Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica. Here's before. That was 1989. This is the same location 7 years later in 1996 after a clear-cutting project. We can hear that it's different, Bernie. We can hear the rushing of the water that wasn't so audible over the din of the birds before. What do you hear in there that is worth noting?
Well, earlier I said that soundscapes are a narrative of place, and they certainly are. And each of these sources of sound contains fragments of stories we need to learn about because together and separately they give us new insights into biology. But they also tell us stories about resource management, medicine, religion, architecture, physics, anthropology, and many other subjects. And in this particular case, what it's telling us is that much of the wildlife that was there and supported by the forest environment is no longer there because the forest is no longer there. Consequently, it doesn't support the living organisms that normally would occur in that particular area. And most important, you know, when we see these things through the lens of soundscape ecology, we get instant feedback, as we just did now in just 15 to 30 seconds of example, as to how well we're relating to our living environment through the multiple ways in which vocal organisms collectively express themselves in the biophony.
How do you decide where to go to collect soundscapes?
Well, I try to find places where there are fewer of, well, as few of us as possible. I like, for instance, I really enjoy my favorite place. People always ask me what my favorite place is. My favorite place is Alaska, because it's a place about the third of the lower 48, it's actually larger than Texas.
And we don't like to talk about that.
No. I won't. I'll watch it. But it has like 600,000 or 700,000 people in it. And so you can actually do what Bill McKibben suggests when you want to get into the wild. You can walk for 2 weeks in any direction and never see a fence or a road. You'll never see signage along a game trail telling you, you know, which way you need to go or how far it is to the next place. You'll never see a ranger telling you about the life cycle of an elk or a bear. And most of all, and best of all, there's nothing to buy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Reeves in Dallas. Hi, Reeves.
Hi. I love this program. It's just terrific. I am a person living in an urban setting, and I feed the birds. And in the morning, I'm welcome to their songs, and I've got other wildlife out back, possums and raccoons occasionally, and I just enjoy it all. But unfortunately, this experience is so diminished by the noise of the lawn crews, which usually run from about 8 o'clock until dusk or, you know, sun goes down. And so it really, has affected my feelings about living here. We're in an old house and have the windows that let all that noise in. So it's not just being outside, but it's, you know, it impacts us inside. And I would like to know if there is a movement toward a more low-tech way of dealing with gardens.
Do you know anything about that, Bernie?
That's a really good subject. Near where we live, we live in the Valley of the Moon in Sonoma County, and it's about 50 miles north of San Francisco. And the town of Sonoma has just banned outright leaf blowers and things that generate a lot of noise. They've just asked people to use the old-fashioned way, rakes. It actually takes a little bit more time and a little bit more energy, but it's very effective if you want to clean your yard. So that's certainly one solution. It's not practical in every instance, but people are beginning to realize that the anthropophony, especially the noise part of it, the incoherent and chaotic noise that we generate with our electromechanical devices, are causing us a lot of stress. And when you look at populations that live in larger metropolitan areas, take a look at the drug prescriptions that people have to take for stress and the numbers of them, and you'll find that it's really correlated to noise in their environment. And you can make a direct connection, a direct link to that. So the question is, what kind of world do we want to live in? And when are we going to make the choices that we need to make to feel better? And that's one of the answers. That's one of the issues.
You mentioned earlier, Bernie, that much of the wilderness in Alaska is sort of unmitigated by rangers trying to escort you around. It's also interesting that in this country we've done a lot of work to set aside places where humans can observe nature without hopefully doing it too much harm, places like national parks. But while we take it as an article of faith that rangers should be able to designate trails for people to walk on and protect fragile plants, there's been more resistance to the idea of protecting soundscapes.
Well, because, you know, there was a fellow by the name of James Watt, who was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Interior.
Right.
And he was one who stopped the funding for the Office of Noise Abatement, which was under the EPA at one point. So he defunded that. And when he was asked why he did that, he came up with a really interesting comment. He said, well, he said, noise is power. And the noisier we are as Americans, the more powerful we appear to be to others. And he kind of endorsed that whole idea of becoming more noisy and bringing more noise into our environment. And as a result, a lot of people have bought into that. And they feel that noise defines who they are. Straight piping motorcycles, jet skis, snowmobiles, really loud mechanical devices that are supposed to be defining us. I'm not sure that's a very good idea. It depends, again, what kind of healthy environment do we want to live in, or do we not care about that?
NPR has a project ongoing right now where it's encouraging people in association with the ornithology lab at Cornell to go out in their backyards and collect sounds that of wildlife that they can't identify. And, of course, that is going to come with a lot of ambient sound of, you know, lawnmowers, like Reeves said, and traffic noise and airplanes. Is there value to trying to capture soundscapes in urban and suburban areas just to get a baseline for what things sound like today and what they might sound like 20 years from now?
Yeah, sure. When I do programs in schools, I give kids in the fourth and fifth grade very inexpensive recorders and tell them to go into their backyard and record the sound of a robin singing, because robins are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're, you know, and they're pretty much happening in certain areas at all times of year, certainly around here. And they go out and they record and they bring it back to me, next day. I do these workshops in the schools for them. And they'll bring the recordings back to me and I'll say, yeah, but I don't quite hear that robin, but I hear the lawnmower and I hear the motorcycles going by and I hear the bus. You know, let's go back and see if we can get the robin. They go back and they go into the in their backyards again, and they bring me the material back again, and it's the same problem. And I say to them, "Well, I'll give you a clue. Try to get up a little earlier in the morning, like around the time the sun comes up, before your parents get up, and sneak out in your backyard and see if you can get the robin then." And they do, and they come back, and they say, and I'll say to them, "Yeah, that's the robin you want to get." And I'll say, yeah, but there's so much noise there other than the robin. I say, that's the idea. What do you want to do about it? And they get the idea right away. And, of course, in our area, we've got another problem. Because this year, when I went out to record near where we live, we live in a rural area. There's a lot of vineyards around here in the Valley of the Moon. And I went to this area to record this year, and surprise, there was absolutely no bird song in the springtime of the year where we live. It is dead silent.
Is that because of drought?
Partly because of a drought that's the worst drought in 1,200 years, and partly, we think, because of global warming.
We have a little bit of sound here from Sugarloaf State Park in California that you put on your website. Can you give us a little context as to what we might hear here? As this is a Sugarloaf in 2004.
Yeah, this is exactly the place that I was talking about, as a matter of fact. In 2004, if you listen to the sound, the density and diversity of birds, the density meaning the total number of species, And I mean the diversity, meaning the total number of species, and the density, meaning the total number of birds altogether. The density is very rich, and it was I use that as my baseline because for the previous 14 years that I'd recorded since 1990, the sound had not changed, and it had been that rich every year, whether we were in a La Nina or El Nino weather pattern.
So
you can hear the stream running through the meadow too. Yeah.
So when you went back and heard almost nothing, were you expecting it to be that stark?
No, I wasn't. And we have a bird feeder out in our backyard, like the woman who just called a few minutes ago, and we have lots of birds coming to the feeder, but we've heard no song this year at all. It is definitely the silent spring.
Do you think other people are noticing this who don't do the work that you do?
I have no idea. Again, we're a visual culture, and if you see birds, then you imagine in your mind that they're going to be vocal or that they are vocal, so that if you see them, you think everything is okay. But the fact that there was no song meant that breeding was not as robust as it usually is, probably, in this area. And so we don't really know what's happening.
My guest is soundscape ecologist, musician, and writer Bernie Krause. His new book is called Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. 10 points for any listener other than my guest, Bernie Krause, who can tell you what you just heard. Bernie Krause is a soundscape ecologist and author of a new book called Voices of the Wild. Bernie, those are Alaskan bearded seals?
Bearded seals, yes. And what's really interesting about that is Weddell seals in the Antarctic do exactly the same thing. And they're 10,000 miles apart. They're separated that far. And they never come in contact with one another. How did they get that voice? Well, we think that is the result of the electrical energy produced by thunderstorms at the equator that's transmitted as radio signals through the magnetic fields of the Earth to both the South and North Poles. They can be picked up by low-frequency radio receivers, as they did by NASA, which we sometimes use to show the similarity between those voices and the actual radio signals received by NASA. And when you compare them, they're almost identical. So what we're thinking is that these animals who have a little bit of magnetite in their heads are able to actually pick up the radio signals and translate them into vocalizations that you've just heard. The vocalizations sound almost electronic. They sound like synthesizers from the 1960s, the early analog synthesizers.
Yeah. Is there any advantage to trying to collect sound with recording equipment that would play back in such a way that we could understand what animals actually hear?
I'm not clear on your question.
I know. I'm not surprised. So right now, you choose recording equipment, and you can choose something that is really directional, so you get sound in a pretty narrow sphere. Obviously, we can only hear what we can hear, but we can manipulate sound, can't we, so that we can understand, for example, what a particular animal might be able to hear that we humans can't hear if we take that information into a studio or a lab and manipulate it?
Yeah, if we're assuming that the range of their voices is what they hear. Now, sometimes, for instance, whales have a much wider frequency range of hearing than we would imagine, and where we actually hear their voices. There are some whales, like, for instance, the blind Ganges dolphin, that has a hearing range that goes up to above 250 kilohertz. It's like 8 octaves beyond the highest note on a piano.
Wow.
To give you an idea of how high, and it has the highest range in the animal kingdom, we think. We're not sure. Whales also have the lowest vocalizations in the animal kingdom. They go way below what we can hear, around 4 or 5 hertz, it is thought. And these are the right whales. So what we would have to do if we actually recorded that infrasound, is what we call it, if we actually recorded those sounds, we'd have to speed them up quite a great deal in order to actually hear the signal with bats that are way higher than what we can hear typically. We would have to slow up the tape in order to hear the signal if we could record it. And in fact, a lot of the digital recorders that are out today can record these very high frequencies or low frequencies.
The available equipment for you and what's affordable has changed a lot over time.
Yeah. Originally, we had analog equipment with analog tape, and the tapes weighed a pound each. The equipment weighed as much as 40 pounds with 12 D-cell batteries. These are the large batteries. And it was very heavy and awkward to carry into the field, along with a tripod and microphones and so on. And like I said earlier, one of the ways that I got started into this field was because I was really thinking of these sounds as more orchestrated sounds. They sounded like orchestrations that we were doing in music, so they were structured in such a way that made me think of them as orchestrations. And I was interested not in recording single sounds or focused sound. I was interested in recording the whole soundscape of a given habitat, because I thought that there was much more information there, and have shown that to be the truth.
I want to play a little bit here from an artist, a musician named David Monacci. We'll play it, and then you can tell us a little bit about his work. All right, if we were, Bernie, in concert and David Monacci was performing, what would we be experiencing when we heard the sound we just heard?
Well, David is a very unusual fellow. He's a professor of music in Italy, near Urbino. And he is one of these rare people who's actually gone into the field and recorded natural soundscapes and used them as a component of orchestration. And this is exactly what he's doing here. He's combining electronics with natural soundscapes that he recorded in the Amazon. That's the Amazon wet season. And incidentally, like I said, these soundscapes are a narrative of place. If you play me a sound, I can probably tell you where it comes from.
Hmm.
All over the world, because the voices are that clear to me now. But Monacci is one of these fellows who really has spent the time, taken the risk, gone to these very remote, out-of-the-way places that are sometimes quite uncomfortable to live in for any period of time. And he's captured these sounds himself and then actually added material to them that round them out for performance pieces. And they're really quite extraordinary. He's one of the very few people I know in the Western culture that's actually incorporated these natural soundscapes in that way.
And then he also streams spectrograms, so we can look at what the sound is doing.
Yeah, exactly right. He's the first performer to do that. And what you see when you go into one of these presentations of his is sometimes it's a full 360-degree in the round habitat, almost like a geodesic dome. And you hear sound coming from everywhere around you because that's the way in which he records them. And then you see these spectrograms streaming across the screen. A spectrogram is a graphic illustration of sound. And it shows the organization of these soundscapes that I've been talking about, like in the biophony, the ways in which the animals are structured, the birds in one niche, the insects and mammals and frogs and so on, and others. And he actually gives people a sense that instead of thinking of sound in terms of visual things, he lets you think of the visual that's reproduced by sound itself.
800-933-5372 is our number. We have Kevin on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I had a question. You guys made a comment earlier in the show about how the natural sounds of the wild are kind of therapeutic and you know, kind of brings us back to our humanity and in a soothing way, and we need to, you know, get more in contact with that. Well, I've noticed recently, I work on a private college campus, and early in the morning, there's just a bunch of songbirds and just kind of a, before the students and the, you know, the hustle and bustle of the campus start, you can, it really kind of sounds like a real segment of nature. And one of the overwhelming comments that I just hear people talking about is how annoying the birds are in the morning. And it's beautiful if you think about it. It's a true nature type of a sound. It's not annoying, you know, single birds here and there. It's kind of like a symphonic kind of birds tweeting here and there, you know, different species of birds. And everybody keeps talking about how annoying it is, and they wish there weren't so many birds on campus. And there's kind of been a shift in the axis of that, going from appreciating the sounds of nature to literally thinking it's annoying. So I just kind of wanted to, you know, hear the comments on, you know, how society has shifted to not appreciating sounds of nature anymore.
Kevin, is it students who were like partying till four that morning and wanted to be sleeping?
No, not necessarily. I mean, this will be just like, you know, like an off weekend. It'll be like maybe a Wednesday or a Thursday or something like that. And just different people, different segments of conversations that I hear throughout the campus, people are like, man, I wish this campus didn't have so many birds, you know, kind of a thing.
Wow.
That's interesting, Kevin. I would say that is a perfect example of what Richard Louv, who I spoke about earlier, who wrote The Last Child in the Woods, it's a perfect example of what he describes as nature deficit disorder. We discount the very thing that we need to make us feel good, to make us feel that we're part of a living world around us. And that's that kind of dismissal is not unusual. I've heard it before. We have a bed and breakfast part on our property, and I had a couple from New York who showed up a while ago, and the couple was supposed to be in there for 3 nights, and I saw them. It was a young couple. And I saw them down at the bottom of the stairs early the next morning because I go out and run several miles a day, and I like to do it early. And so I got up and I saw them at the bottom of the stairs with all their suitcases and everything. I said, "What's wrong?" And they said, "Oh, those crickets last night, they drove us crazy. And we got to get out of here. We got to get back to the city." And so they rented a room right on Union Square in San Francisco where all the hustle and bustle and noise and activity was there. And that's part of the thing that I've been talking about this whole program.
How much is noise mitigation a factor in proposals for new construction, new development? I mean, it seems like there's maybe talk about how much noise there will be while somebody is putting up a building or a facility, but not necessarily so much about the long-term effects.
It depends on where it is. Mm-hmm. It depends on whether it's a large city or a small city. It depends on whether it's a place like we live, which are really made of a bunch of small towns like Sonoma or Glen Ellen. And if those are issues to the people who live there and really they like a little bit more tranquility, you're going to find that they're going to be more sensitive to noise, and that will be part of the issue of this construction.
Something that's been an issue in this part of the country is the noise from wind turbines, which you don't necessarily think about when you see them far away on the horizon, but they emit a sound.
The early wind turbines were putting out quite a bit of low-frequency cavitation, and it caused people downwind from the wind turbines to really get quite stressed. Their property values were diminished. Some of them had to move out of their homes because the noise was so intrusive. And I think some of that now has been mitigated because the aerodynamics of the blades and the turbines themselves have changed quite a bit and improved. So I think there's some improvement in that area now.
When you are outside and you don't have your recording equipment with you, but you just want to enjoy being outside, maybe on your runs or whatever, what are you listening for?
Oh, I never take earphones or music or anything with me when I'm outside because I really want to hear what the world is telling me. It's where I get my news. It's the national news for me.
And I would imagine it just like the things that you see change throughout the year as the seasons change and with the weather, the world sounds different on a cloudy day than it does on a crisp, sunny day.
Absolutely, and it changes hour to hour from dawn to dusk and through the night. And, you know, we've just discovered something new, and that's the biophonic expression is structured as if Darwin himself was defining the sonic timelines of evolution. The choruses in a healthy habitat go like this, and this is what we're talking about. First, the insects establish their acoustic territory within the frequency spectrum. And then the reptiles and the amphibians join the chorus, establishing other niches. And once those are set, then come the birds and finally the mammals, all of the critters together creating not only frequency bandwidth, but temporal niches as well.
Bernie Krause is a soundscape ecologist, musician, and author of the new book Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can learn more about his work at wildsanctuary.com. Bernie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
It was my pleasure. Take care, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.